I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what really happened to immigrant children separated from their parents and why so many remained apart after the court-ordered deadline for reunification? We'll spend this hour with Frontline producer Martin Smith, who's been investigating the effects of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy for undocumented border crossings. We'll also get some context on how Donald Trump's actions to curb immigration compare with those of Barack Obama, who was nicknamed Deporter-in-Chief when he was president. Our conversation starts after a short break. Deadline for undocumented immigrant children to be reunited with their families was last Thursday. But as of Sunday, more than 700 of those kids, mostly from Central America, remained in federal custody. So what have their lives been like since they were separated, and what will happen to them now? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Martin Smith is a correspondent and producer for the documentary series Frontline and has been investigating this story. He wanted to explore the fallout from the policy that called for separation of immigrant children from their parents and to compare Trump administration efforts to limit undocumented immigration with the efforts of the Obama administration before it. The episode Separated, Children at the Border airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. Martin Smith joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston to talk about it. Martin, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You open the documentary with a woman named Maritza Amaya, who was traveling with her infant son. What drove her north from El Salvador?
Well, her brother had been murdered some years back. And, I mean, the backstory of that, which we don't even get into the details of it, but that she had been in a place where there was a lot of crossfire between two fighting gangs. And then she decided to move out of that neighborhood. When she moved out of that neighborhood, she was suspected of taking sides in the gang war because she moved into another neighborhood that was another turf claimed by one of the gangs. And so then she was directly threatened. So she lost her brother. She's faced a lot of threats. And so she came here with her 9-month-old son, Wilfredo. She happened to come in at a time when the policy was in place to separate them, but fortunately, somehow, she was able to persuade a guard that, given that she was nursing her son, that she would not be separated. And the day I met her was the very day that the president reversed his order and dropped the separation policy that he'd been pursuing for over a month. Or really over a year, but officially, explicitly for the last 6 weeks.
So she's been released but outfitted with an ankle monitor. Is that standard practice these days for asylum seekers awaiting adjudication of their claims?
You know, you ask what's standard practice. You know, I can't discern standard practice. It may be in the books as a standard practice, but not everybody that was released was given an ankle bracelet. So it was hard to know. There's so many rules and exceptions to rules and people that don't, you know, officials, officers that don't follow the rules by the book, other ones that do. But it's not uncommon for many of them to wear an ankle bracelet so they can be monitored as they go through the asylum process, which can take a long time. It can take years. Whether she has to wear that the whole time, I don't know.
You know, it may be the least of their worries for people like Maya and others, but an ankle bracelet is pretty stigmatizing, right? You see someone wearing one of those out in the community and you assume that they have committed a crime, a different sort of crime maybe than violating immigration policy.
Yeah, it's a humiliation. And all she's done is done what she thought was right for herself and her son, and made the difficult journey up across Mexico, comes into the United States, applies for asylum, and gets fitted with an ankle bracelet that stigmatizes her. And every 2 weeks she has to report to authorities while her case is pending. And she fears, as she breaks down in tears when I ask her if she's still afraid of being deported. You know, it's it's very troubling what her future is.
How did the kind of violence that Amaya fled in El Salvador spread to Guatemala and Honduras? Is it the same groups of individuals involved?
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily causal. It's simply a phenomenon mm-hmm. that cropped up simultaneously. But to roll back a little further, and this is outside the parameters of this report, but many of these gang leaders were deported from Los Angeles area back in the 90s. And we thought if we deported them all, the problem would go away. And in fact, the gangs took deep roots in these countries, Guatemala, Honduras, Salvador, and now have caused a flood of people coming. Well, flood, that's inaccurate. I shouldn't say flood, but have caused a number of people to come up here. There's a lot of mischaracterization of just how much, you know, how many migrants we're facing. It's certainly less than that the president would have you believe.
You put that word, that term, that idea in context for us. So we talk about a surge. People, you'll hear the word flood. I think a lot of people imagine like throngs of people overwhelming border defenses. Is that what it looks like at the southern border?
Well, we are at a low. We are at a multi-decade low in the number of people that have been arrested coming across illegally our southern border. To listen to the rhetoric on the campaign trail, and this has been a golden issue for President Trump as he was announcing his candidacy, he made it clear that he was campaigning to and appealing to people who believed somehow that there was this flood. It's not a flood. You know, back in, I think, 2000, there were about 1.6 million illegal crossings. It's now down to about 300,000 or less. And it dipped a little bit after Trump took over because people were trying to figure out what his approach would be, but it's creeped back up. But it's roughly been flat for some time now.
So the trip alone can be really dangerous. Lots of families head north on the freight train known as La Bestia, the Beast. Can you tell us about that route?
Yeah, you'll see it in the documentary tonight, and the pictures are just astounding. I mean, they were to me, to see thousands of these people that get on, they cross Guatemala, they get into Mexico, and then they look for the beast, as they call it. And you'll see why. It's a big old freight train, and they climb up and they take a perch on top of the train, and you see hundreds of them on top of riding this train north to the border. Many of them are bringing money with them because they're going, they're leaving their homes, and so gangs get up on top of the train and rob them. And some even fail to get on the train. They can't get on at station stops when the train is halted, so they get on as the train is moving. And it's hard for especially the very young to get up, you know, where the ladder is above their waist. And some of them fall and lose a limb or even die trying to get on the train.
I feel like I follow this issue pretty closely, but I have to tell you, Martin, I was stunned to learn how common sexual assault has become.
Amnesty International and other and at least one other group that monitors that have found that 6 out of 10 women experience rape on the trip up. So women are much more vulnerable than the men that come up. Many of them take some form of birth control. We were told many of the women get injections for birth control because the chances are that they will be sexually assaulted.
Does hiring a coyote, a smuggler, help somebody get across the border more safely?
It can. The beast is something that's ridden by people with with not enough means to hire a coyote. A coyote, the going price for a coyote is about $7,000.
Wow.
And that, you know, if you're middle class and or you've got something you can mortgage, you can raise that kind of money, or you can get some money sent to you by a relative that's in the States. And it doesn't, it can help ease that journey, but it's not necessarily the case that everybody that hires a coyote is going to be all right. Many of these coyotes are affiliated with gangs in Mexico, with cartels, and there have been numerous incidents where people who are using coyotes have met death. So for the most part, I think you are safer if you have a good human smuggler, a coyote as they call them, helping you get up and across. And you can make the trip all the way across Mexico, out of Salvador, across Guatemala, up through Mexico in less than 2 weeks. But others run into Mexican authorities and get deported back, have to try again. Some get with a coyote who's not honest or tries to extort more money from you along the way. So it's a very risky journey, and all what it tells you is how desperate people are to get up and into the U.S.
What is supposed to happen when someone presents himself or herself to border officials and requests asylum in the United States?
Right. No matter whether you come in at a legal checkpoint or come in illegally between checkpoints, you have a right under U.S. and international law to apply for asylum. Whether you're a man or a woman or a child, you have a right to ask for asylum. What these people are doing, they're not coming up and trying to avoid Border Patrol. They're coming up, crossing the Rio Grande, crossing into Arizona, New Mexico, California, and seeking out a Border Patrol agent to turn themselves in and requesting asylum.
Okay, so the parents that you met, a number of the parents that you met who had been separated from their children, told you that they weren't expecting this. What was the Obama administration's policy for dealing with families that were apprehended together for crossing without permission?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, you raise a good point that they didn't know that they were going to face this when they came in, which tells you something about the failure of the government to use this as a workable deterrent program, because if you want to deter people, you have to alert them beforehand that they're facing this. So they were coming up and not knowing that they were going to have their children taken from them. And so it wasn't working as a deterrent. The Obama administration did do more outreach and spent more money in Central America to alert people to what their rights were. They even set up asylum places where people could apply for asylum down in Guatemala and Salvador and Honduras. But one of the things that I think is a takeaway from this film, this broadcast, is how difficult it is for anyone to get this policy right. And the Obama administration struggled mightily with this. And it was at a time when they were trying to push through the legislation, the DACA legislation for Dreamers. These are kids that are raised in the States by illegal parents. They were born here. They were raised here. And he was granting them rights to stay. At this very time, the word got out that this program was being pushed through by the Obama administration. And the cartels used this as a and falsely advertised this as meaning that if you came up now, you could get in. And we saw a surge of young migrants in 2014, as well as families with children coming up, thinking, being told that this was the time to come. And the Obama administration, facing this, had to get tough on the border because they were under a lot of pressure on Capitol Hill that if they wanted to get their reforms through, they had to get tough at the border. Republicans were pressuring them. So Obama got the reputation as the deporter-in-chief. He increased expedited deportations. And he also, for the families that were coming in, built out a series of family detention centers. And we can talk a little bit more about that after your break.
My guest is Frontline producer and correspondent Martin Smith. We're talking about the program Separated: Children at the Border. It airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Martin Smith, the correspondent and producer for Frontline. The Frontline documentary, Separated, Children at the Border, airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. If you want to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk a little bit about the procedure sometimes referred to as catch and release. If I understand correctly, this came about as a result of something called the Flores Settlement. What is the Flores Settlement and what does it require for children?
Yeah, the Flores Settlement is important to all of this. And without getting in the weeds, it was a decision made after a class action lawsuit on behalf of a young migrant that her name was Jenny Flores. And it was a case in which the lawyer, the attorney, and the class filed the class action was saying, you know, these detention centers are not suitable places for young children. And that was a time during after the wars in Central America that there were a number of people coming up. These countries down there were failing, and there were people, young people coming up, and they were being put in these detention centers, and the conditions were very bad. So there was a suit filed on behalf of Jenny Flores as the lead plaintiff in the class action suit, and the case was won, and it set strictures on how long you could hold a child in detention. So this came back up when Obama was putting families in the, you know, just back in his, during his terms, into family detention. And people came forward and said, you know, we can't keep children in these detention centers under Flores, even if they are with their parents. And this was fought out in the courts. And again, the ruling was that children, even if they're with their parents in family detention, can't be held. So Obama was faced with either keeping the parents in detention or separating the children out, as the Trump administration has done, and putting them into shelters or finding relatives where they could be. The case was that even if they're with their parents, they have to, they can't be held. And Obama decided to let families go intact and to monitor where the families were and let them go through the process of applying for their asylum while they were intact and in the U.S. And that was the Obama approach. At one point, they did consider separating, but they quickly rejected it. So Flores forced those terms on the Obama administration.
Was there an indication that families considering migrating across the border knew that they, if they were caught, they would be released and therefore brought children with them on purpose when they might not otherwise have done so?
You know, I've heard this. I'm really not certain that that's the case. I'm sure that it probably was the case with some, but by and large, people are trying to get their whole families out, and therefore they're coming together for reasons that, like you saw in the program that you'll see tonight, these are people that are fleeing, regardless of what they might face, and are coming with their children. So I'm not so sure that it was an incentive for people to come because they thought they would be caught and released. This is something that that annoys President Trump, or at least he says he's annoyed by it, and it plays to his base, that catch and release is too lenient and that we're letting these people out and that they're bad people and they're committing crimes. That's not true. Their crime rates are lower than that of Native Americans. You can imagine if you're applying for asylum, you don't want to do anything that might get you in trouble with the law if you're serious about your asylum claim. So the fact is that these people come, they get jobs, they pay taxes. You know, right now we have a labor shortage in the United States. And avocados are not being picked in California. And in other places you hear reports about problems that employers are having. And there are many alternatives to putting these people into detention and separating their children and sending them to shelters that are cheaper than what we are doing now. You know, but we're not having, I would say, we're not having a rational discussion about this. politics are being played.
How did the Trump administration decide to separate undocumented parents from their children? And this, am I correct that it includes people seeking asylum? It also includes people who might be characterized as economic migrants that are being separated. Is that right?
Right. Well, some of those economic migrants might be applying for asylum. And they can make a case, or they can try to make a case, that their economic straits in their home country is due to the violence that is wreaking havoc on those countries. So there's indirect effects of violence. There's direct, you know, threats to people's lives. And there's also problems with the society being crushed by waves of violence and people losing jobs and stability. But yes, people can come in. And what the Trump administration decided to do was to first announce a zero-tolerance policy, which meant that they were going to arrest everybody who came across, no questions asked. Anybody who came across illegally would be arrested and put into a detention center. And if they had family with them, they'd be put with their children in the in these centers, these family detention centers. But under the Flores settlement, the children couldn't stay there. They had to leave. There was a 20-day limit as to how long they could stay there. So rather than let the families go out intact while their asylum claim was while they applied for asylum, the Trump administration decided to keep the parents in detention while they were being prosecuted and send the children to shelters. And they said they were forced to do this by the laws on the books. Well, they made this like a binary choice. You either are separating them for the children, or you have to release them intact. Well, there are many other choices. They could, use different monitoring systems. Different systems were in place under Obama that were canceled under Trump. And Trump has a kind of, how should I say? It's like, let's enforce the law to the letter of the law and not think hard about coming up with alternative, more humane policies that would be acceptable to more people. Because his separation policy was rejected not only by the left or Democrats, but by many people on the right. He was forced under political pressure to reverse it.
I think a lot of people can imagine that separation from their parents would be traumatic to children. But, Martin, is there documented evidence that children are being harmed by this separation?
Well, there certainly seems to be in the cases that we looked at. Now, one of the problems here as a reporter is access to these families and access to the centers where they're held is pretty strictly limited by the government. And so a lot of work still needs to be done by journalists and others into just what the conditions were like, what the experience was like for children. And you have to know something about the child before they go in to judge what they are like after they go out. So it's a big task. But the two families that we looked at, it was clear to me that in one case, a six-year-old girl was quite affected by the experience and now is very much afraid of letting go of her father, who she was separated from. And in another case, a mother with her 15-year-old daughter, the mother reports that she had a sweet disposition before and is now quite angry. And when we talked to the daughter, she just broke down. She says, I just can't even begin to think about what it is that I've been through. So in those two cases, and albeit anecdotal or limited, there was clearly consequences for these kids.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's start with David in Austin. Hi, David.
Hi. I feel uninformed on this, but perhaps you can help me. If it costs $7,000 to retain a coyote to go north across the border, is it possible to just fly into the United States and overstay your visa?
Well, you've got to get a visa to begin with, and that's not necessarily so easy. You mean to apply for some kind of tourist visa into the United States? I assume that if that was so easy, yes, people would do that. And I don't know of instances where that path is being taken.
We have an email here from James who wants to know, doesn't international law that people use to seek sanctuary in the United States also dictate they are required to seek it in the first country they reach, which for Central Americans would be Mexico?
Well, Mexico is pretty strict about rejecting people's asylum claims. And Mexico is not the desired destination. Many of these people fleeing violence in Central America have relatives already in the United States, and so they prefer to come to the United States. Many are, and I don't have stats on this, but many are deported from Mexico after making asylum claims. They're more comfortable with getting to the U.S. border and making their claim here.
All right. Let's speak now with Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I think this is a simple question. I'm probably not going to get to watch the show, but if I do, is someone on the show going to give me an idea of, after what's been seen, what's going to be reported in this show, what the solution is? Because we've been inundated with, well, as he mentioned, anecdotes, but we've been inundated with stories for months about what's happening on the border, but nobody's talked about what we can do. I mean, people either come in or they can't come in.
What do you think?
Right. Well, I think you'll understand the difference between the two presidents' policies. People who would like to see open path to asylum would look at the Obama administration and look at its policies and think that there was a solution in that. In the case of President Trump, he has clamped down so heavily on the border and made it a law enforcement issue, and has even said that he wants fewer judges and more border patrol agents. And without judges, you have no kind of asylum process. And in fact, there seems to be, well, it's very clear that they don't really want to provide a very easy path for asylum. It's already pretty difficult, even under Obama. But with fewer judges and more lawmen, you're going to enforce the law and you're going to deport more people. And that's what's been happening.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Martin, is there a difference in the law or in U.S. policy between asylum granted to potential victims of persecution, you know, political dissidents in particular countries, as compared with people who fear harm through gang violence, which I think in the U.S. conception is like street crime, and maybe we imagine that you could just move to another part of town in the country that you live in?
Well, that's right. I mean, all of these people are fleeing gang violence. They're not fleeing state violence. And the law is written in such a way that you have a easier path to asylum if you're fleeing state violence. That's what it's written for. So there's a challenge right now for these people to make a case that they can't just move to another part of Salvador or Guatemala. And you're absolutely right. The law is written in that way. But somehow some of these people are pursuing claims. The reason we have judges is that so that people can make judgments about what is a legitimate claim and what lives up to the ideals and promises that undergird America. And, you know, this isn't a clear case of just reading by the letter of the law. You know, I talked to the former director of ICE. He's a lawman. He wants to enforce the law, pure and simple. He doesn't want to think particularly hard about the gray area between like open border on one side and zero tolerance on the other.
Do you think it's inappropriate for him to say he doesn't want to think about the gray area?
I think he's a lawman and he's following orders. And so that's, you know, he was chief of ICE. I would hope that when you rise to a position of that much responsibility, you're in the room with policymakers, you might want to express other opinions. But he's a lawman. He's come up as a lawman. And, you know, I understood him. I said to him after the interview, I get it. You're a lawman. You want to enforce the law. But what about X, Y, and Z? How about these children? Well, why punish these children for, you know, you're blaming the parents, but the children are the ones being punished here along with the parents. He seemed uncomfortable. I would have hoped that he would want to think more critically.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Becca calling from San Antonio. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for taking my call. I really appreciate the time that you're spending on this, and especially for us in Texas. I know we're not the only state on the border, but we do obviously make up a very substantial part of the border between the United States and Mexico. And we have an election coming up in November. And as far as our choices, especially when it comes to the governor, you know, we have Governor Abbott, who's already made it pretty clear that, I mean, he's given pretty much free rein to the federal government when it comes to our border. And then we have Lupe Valdez, who is has a bit of a checkered past herself when it comes to her time as sheriff of Dallas County. And then we also have Mark Tippett, who's the Libertarian candidate, who actually was born and raised in Mexico and is bilingual and has a, you know, he does consulting for businesses and individuals in Mexico as well. And so my question is kind of, first of all, what can the governor do in the light of federal regulations and rules like this? What power does the governor have? And when it comes to the choices that we have, what looks like the right path forward when it comes to trying to make the most humanitarian and, you know, truthfully, I think the most American decisions when it comes to this situation?
Well, big questions there, Becca. We will take a quick break and then see if Martin has a response. We will be back to the conversation in 2 minutes. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Martin Smith is with us this hour. He's a producer for Frontline, and the Frontline documentary Separated, Children at the Border, airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Frontline's Martin Smith about the documentary Separated, Children at the Border, that airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. Before the break, Martin, we heard from a caller who wanted to know what role do governors have in all of this?
You know, it's a smart question, and I'd be foolish to try to wade into parsing local politics in Texas. I'm not from Texas. But I would say that what people can do is be informed. It's always the case, not to be too glib, but I mean, the best thing is for people to vote based on solid information. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of posturing when it comes to this issue. It's a hot button issue. What we are doing in this documentary tonight is allowing people to see up close some of the people who are affected by this policy, because I think in news snippets, the humanity of some of these people is lost. Some of these people are coming into airports and facing a barrage of cameras and reporters. We tried to have some quieter moments with some of the children and the parents, and that's what you'll see. And because I think it behooves us to know who they are rather than listening to misrepresentations of the kind of people they are or aren't. I sat in a McAllen, Texas courtroom, and there were 59 people that were coming in to be arraigned, and they were shackled ankles and the wrists, and they were dirty and they were tired. But to a person, a man and men and women, I did not get a sense that we were dealing with a population of rapists or criminals. And when the judge interrogated them, before their arraignments or during their arraignment process, it was clear that these were people very much like you and me, of that have fallen on hard circumstances and are simply trying to save their skins and make their way north. And now you can disagree with their you can say you don't want these people in the country, but there should be some kind of process whereby they can be, their cases can be heard and adjudicated. Because the alternative to that is to not think about this at all and just have the law enforced strictly separating people from their children. And that didn't go very well. Almost all people were not very happy with that. And it became an embarrassment to the United States around the world, in fact.
Why has the government missed its own deadline to get all these families reunited?
They've missed their deadline in part because they say some of these people should not be returned to their to whoever brought them up. But I think that's a minority. The majority of this is because they lost track of who went with whom. And they sent a lot of people, hundreds of people, back to their home countries and telling them that their children would be reunited with them. But given the state of record keeping and the lack of communication between Border Patrol, ICE, Health and Human Services, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and various agencies of the government that were handling these cases were not talking to one another. Their computers were not linked together. It reminds me very much of 9/11 when that tragedy happened. It was in large part because the CIA and the FBI weren't talking. The computers didn't talk. So you have these stovepiped agencies handling these children and these refugees, and it's pretty appalling that they were allowed to be separated without clear records being kept on who was where.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Rose is calling from Austin. Hi, Rose.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A previous caller mentioned about, you know, stopping in Mexico, coming up from Central America, and Martin was talking about how that may not be possible, but how about going south? To Panama, to Colombia, or even further south? Is that an option? My second question is, what are we doing to make these failed states, which is what kind of what you're implying, make these failed states, you know, help them turn around so that they don't have to keep on exporting their poverty, essentially?
Thanks for your call.
You know, the issue of going south, we've recommended that to various people that we've met along the way, or at least we've asked them, why wouldn't you consider going to Costa Rica or to Colombia? And many of them have family or connections in the United States, and others are just attracted by the United States. And maybe some of those are economic cases. Because if you're fleeing violence, Costa Rica or some of these other states in Latin America wouldn't be bad choices. I think that's I think that's a good question. As far as helping right these states, I mean, it's ironic to me because I spent a lot of time in the 80s covering the wars in Central America, that those governments and states that we supported, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, are the very states that are in trouble today and causing the instability in those countries is causing the problem we're facing. So that's an irony here. Obama put Vice President Biden in charge of trying to come up with ways to help improve living conditions in these countries. And he had, therefore, to go to Congress and beg for money. And all that he was able to get was $750 million. It's not a lot of money, given the size of the task. And such programs have been cut back by the Trump administration. So at this point, there's a recognition that something needs to be done to get these countries on a better path. But we haven't put real muscle or money behind it.
I have spoken to people, Martin, and perhaps you have as well, American citizens who are not unsympathetic to the plight of folks who come here asking for asylum, but who feel like we can't take everybody. I mean, how many asylum seekers has the U.S. absorbed in previous waves of refugees?
Well, look, I think it's rare to find anybody who thinks we should just throw open the border. And I'm sympathetic with you. You cannot take on the whole world. And the fact is that conditions in certain African countries, certainly Syria, Iraq, their right to asylum is as legitimate as that of somebody coming from Salvador. And so we can't just prioritize these migrants. But I'll go back to what I said earlier. You have to have a working asylum system in order to make determinations as to whether or not this person or that person deserves to come here. And you have to deal with the very difficult job of deciding what the criteria should be for giving somebody asylum. And then once you can clarify that and you can put more judges to work, then you have a system that is ideally much more humane, certainly more humane than what we've seen. I think most people would agree that separating children from their parents was not a good idea. But you need more judges, and that's not the direction in which the Trump administration has wanted to go. But certainly open borders, as characterized by the president, he says the Democrats all want open borders. Well, that's just not true. That's not what people are saying. So we're not having a rational debate. We're having a political food fight, and it's disheartening, and people are being hurt in the meantime.
What were you able to learn about the welfare and the care of children who have been separated from their parents? Are their emotional needs being addressed in custody as well as their physical needs?
That's an impossible question for me to answer, and it's a very good question for you to ask. We don't have access to those shelters. The pictures you see come from government handout films. The conditions in these various privately run shelters varies tremendously. Some allow access. Most don't allow any cameras whatsoever. In fact, one of the hardest things to get a hold of was any pictures from within these child shelters. So you're right to ask. And I'm sorry that I can't tell you much about the conditions inside. But let me just say this: no matter what the conditions are, these kids are separated from their parents. And if they were at a Ritz-Carlton or a Four Seasons, but separated from their parents and not knowing if they were going to ever see them again, those conditions or those playgrounds or whatever they have in there aren't going to make up for that loss. As to what kind of counseling is available, we don't know. We know that a judge, at least, has determined that they were being given psychotropic drugs to calm them down. And the young girl who I met in Salvador that came back, the 6-year-old girl, Maybelline, reported to us. We didn't put this in the program because we don't know really what it was. But she reported that she received several injections with needles while she was in custody. Now, was that a vaccination or was that a sedative? We just don't know, but we should know. We should know what we're doing with these children.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones. Natalie is on the line in Houston. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. I'm actually from a different state. I just moved here. So I am totally new to the area, and I have no idea where to begin as far as what I could do to help. So my question is, what can I do? What are organizations are out there? I've registered to vote, but I want to know where I can spend my time.
Any thoughts, Martin?
Well, I'm not the person to ask that question, unfortunately. There are a number of organizations. I visited a shelter run by Catholic Charities, run by a woman named Norma Pimentel in McAllen, Texas. You could certainly get in touch with them and ask them for what they might know about programs in your area. She was set up in 2014 and has seen a lot and is very eager to certainly channel the volunteer corps in the right direction. But outside of that, I can't say that I have enough on-the-ground knowledge of what's going on in Texas, I'm sorry to say.
Why did President Trump decide to reverse his own administration's policies? Was that about public pressure?
Absolutely, it was about public pressure. He was getting public pressure from Republicans. He was getting public pressure from the Pope and from European leaders. Not sure how much he cares about that, but it was enough that he felt that he had to back down. When the ProPublica tape of the crying children mm-hmm. was released, it was only 2 days after that he reversed the policy.
How likely are families who have asked for asylum to receive it based on the violence in Central America? Can you even ballpark this? Is it a tenth? Is it 90%? Is it somewhere in between?
It takes a long time, and I don't know the percentages, I'm sorry to say. I think but it can take easily 6 to 7 or 8 years for the decision to be finally made. And that is an indication of how backlogged and how weak our system is for adjudicating these cases. We just don't have enough judges. And a lot of these people, even who come in at legal checkpoints, are being turned away and told not that they can't come in, but that they can't come in now. So can you come back when we have bed space in the processing centers? Can you come back, in weeks or months? Which is impossible for many of these people because they're sitting in Mexican towns that are run by drug cartels in very dangerous situations, and if they have any money left on them, they're at risk of losing it. So we have we need a more robust system. As a percentage, how many of these people are going to get through? I'm sorry, I just don't know the stats on that.
You and I have spoken before on this show. Frontline is always about something serious. I'm hearing, Martin, a frustration in your voice that sounds new to me. Is this story particularly affecting for you personally as a journalist?
You're correct, because most of the things I cover have two sides in opposition. And this, of course, has two sides. But the case, while we can't solve what our immigration system, what recommendations to make for fixing the immigration system might be, we can certainly discern what it shouldn't be. And I think I have to say that in this case, I feel strongly that we cannot be separating children from their parents. It's unfortunately wrong.
Martin Smith is a correspondent and producer for the documentary series Frontline. The episode Separated, Children at the Border airs tonight on PBS stations. Martin, thanks so much for making time to speak with us.
Chris, thank you very much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Alan Roberts ran the board for us today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERATHINK. My Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. You can find the podcast and learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.